Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talked to Stephen Bush and George Eaton about Trident Renewal and the People's PMQs. Then Stephen joins us again, plus Barbara Speed, to talk about his Dark Materials and what our demons would be. The issue of Trident, the UK's nuclear deterrent, has come back onto the agenda with a potential split between Jeremy Corbyn, who is very anti-nuclear, and his party, who are pro for very different reasons. I'm going to talk to Stephen, our Staggers editor, and George, our politics editor, who have both written about this for the magazine this week. George, I'm going to start with you. Corbyn has been a lifelong unilateralist, and although he's made compromises on things like NATO membership, there's no sign that this is something that he will compromise on, is there?
Absolutely. So he feels that he has a mandate from the members for this position. He's never disguised his support for unilateral disarmament. But of course, that puts him at odds with a lot of Labour MPs and with significantly most of his shadow cabinet. So I think apart from Corbyn, there are only four other confirmed unilateralists in the shadow cabinet. And crucially, the vote on renewal is going to be held by next March at the latest. And so Labour's currently carrying out a defence review led by the Shadow Defence Secretary Maria Eagle, who's a Trident supporter, but has said the review will be completely open. It will examine Trident on the basis of facts and figures. So that was an attempt by Corbyn to neutralise the issue for now, to kick it into the long grass. But Labour will have to vote on renewal. And the question is what will it do? And most Shadow Cabinet members expect Corbyn to ultimately offer a free vote. As odd as that may seem, when it's an issue which of national security, which parties normally have to take a united position on, it's the only way they think that Corbyn can vote against Trident renewal while most of his shadow cabinet vote in favour of it.
So there's that great quote in the piece from Michael Duggar, who's now the shadow culture secretary, saying it's the first time a Labour leader will offer a free vote so he can vote against party policy. Stephen, you went into some of the punishingly wonkish detail about conference and its role in this. So one of the things that Jeremy Corbyn has been quite keen on is using conference and using grassroots memberships, where he has a huge mandate, to kind of say to the PLP, well, look, this is what the membership want. The trouble is, that's not going to work in this case, is it? Can you tell us why not?
So basically, at the last conference, the conference had two opportunities to vote on Trident. One as a submitted motion by a local branch, which was voted down by both constituency delegates and trade union delegates. And then the section Britain and the World, which was then voted through by conference, includes a paragraph about maintaining the nuclear deterrent. Now, under the letter of Labour's rulebook, you can't then bring it back for 2 years, and that's two full conferences. So you can't say have a special, you can't kick that forward in any way.
Have a special conference like the one that the leadership election.
Yeah, you've got to have the full thing. The difficulty is though, is that most people I think would accept, and definitely privately, a lot of people who are pro the deterrent concede this, then they might have won it by the spirit of the rule, the letter of the rules, but in spirit, delegates did not know when they voted through Britain and the World that they were reconfirming Trident. They thought they were voting through some warm words about you know, the EU, NATO, love, truthiness, all of that. So the rules are on Corbyn's opponent's side, but I think, you know, I think in most courts, a judge would go, well, no, yeah, actually.
But the role of the trade unions is quite interesting, isn't it, George? Because they are primarily concerned with this from a jobs point of view. So, there are potentially more than 1,000 jobs at risk if Trident moves out. So is that going to be a problem for people like Unite, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, the UK's largest trade union represents thousands of defence workers. And Jeremy Corbyn has emphasised several times now that everyone who would lose their jobs through scrapping Trident would be found alternative employment, and that not a penny, he said, that would be saved from disarmament should be spent until we've used it to invest in jobs. The problem, as one trade unionist I speak to in Barrow in the piece says, is that they don't regard these claims of diversification as credible. Mm-hmm. And he said, we commissioned a report in the 1980s called Oceans of Work, looking at whether there would be alternative employment for those who build the Trident submarines were the project not to go ahead. And the employers simply told us, we'd be better off putting the money in the Barrow Building Society because we'd get a better rate of return. And they say, if Trident Renewal doesn't go ahead, there will be no manufacturing in Barrow and 8,000 jobs will go.
I think, which is an interesting point. But also the other one that I think is that there has to be some answer to is the thing that Diane Abbott said to you, I think, Stephen, which is that, Trident can't be used without the approval of the Americans. It does nothing to combat cyber threats, which we know are an increasingly big worry for national security, or jihadists. And actually, have we got the capacity to use it? I mean, I think that's one thing, surely, the lesson we've learned from Syria is that these deterrents are of no use unless people feel that you would actually use them. Is there a kind of even a quite hawkish argument against Trident, specifically Trident, even if not the idea generally?
So there's the argument that you're better off spending it on conventional forces. From a wonkish perspective, I don't think that stacks up, because Trident is basically a virility symbol. Whether or not you think it's an effective virility symbol is actually the policy question. You can't replace the kind of phallic symbolism of having a big old nuke with anything else. So the argument is purely whether or not you think it works as a symbol, which is a much more open question. I mean, the reason why it's so fraught is it hits across so many different Labour divides, not least because Unite and the GMB, another big affiliate unions, compete for members
among
defence staff. So, and the GMB is much more hawkish about it, partly because that is because one of the things we all kind of absorb the way the right-wing press describes them as barons. And of course, these are two competing politicians at the head of effectively two competing businesses. And so it's in the GMB's interest to go, look, we are more hawkish than Unite. Mm. But Unite believe that it is also in their interest to compete as the most left-wing big union. And so you have a lot of different pressures there. And it is, as Diane also said to me, it's totemic. It's a cultural issue within the Labour Party, far more than it's one of defence. It is just something that people are opposed or for in their bones.
And that kind of comes back to some of the 80s stuff, isn't it, where it's felt that some of the reason that Labour weren't treated credibly in the 80s was because they weren't playing in the big boys game, because they didn't have the backing for the kind of big boy symbol, right?
Yeah, and the poster from the 1987 election, which kind of lives on for a generation of Labour politicians and activists on what we might call the soft left or the centre of the party, is a photo of a soldier with his hands in the air. Labour's defence policy is the slogan. And Neil Kinnock gave an interview to the Press Association this week, and he said, look, we just have to live with the reality that you can't win an election if you are anti-Trident or Polaris or whatever it's been called through history.
And I want to just wrap up finally, George, by asking you about Prime Minister's questions, because Jeremy Corbyn, who's been trying his sort of people's Prime Minister's questions, eased up a bit on that this week. Was it successful?
This week's PMQs was quite scrappy. Neither Cameron nor Corbyn clearly came out on top. And then, unlike the previous week when Corbyn devoted all six of his questions to tax credit cuts and Cameron sort of avoided them all to the awkwardness of some of his MPs. But I mean, this week he is still throwing in the odd people's questions. He had one from a Gulf War veteran this week and was pointing out that a private in the army would lose £2,000 next April from tax credit cuts. But just to link it back to defence, Cameron had quite a neat riposte when he said, well, you've said in the past that you can't conceive of any circumstances in which the armed forces would be deployed. Serving soldiers wouldn't have jobs if you were Labour leader. Now, I'm sure Jeremy Corbyn would have a response to that, but it's quite a neat riposte at PMQs. But what was interesting this week was that Cameron at the start was very careful not to attack Jeremy Corbyn. He didn't want to be seen to ridicule him. He wanted to cast himself as the father of the nation, treating the new leader of the opposition with respect. That changed this week, and he said in response to a question on the NHS, I don't think the NHS is going to have a winter crisis. Labour's heading for a winter crisis. Said your media advisors are Stalinist, your policy advisors are Trotskyist, your economics advisor is a communist, and some may see that as a sign of weakness, but a sign that Cameron's rattled. But it's perhaps more likely reflective of his confidence. He thinks he can now safely, after seeing Jeremy Corbyn's rather low personal ratings, thinks he can get away with attacking him.
Isn't it also that before, and the reason why, and there are lots of reasons in my view why it was a mistake to go back to the old PMQs, but it's very difficult for a prime minister to attack
Riveter from Walthamstow.
Yeah, that just makes you look like an awful person. Whereas everyone dislikes, most people dislike all politicians pretty much equally. The evidence from the polls isn't they dislike Cameron, but they dislike Jeremy Corbyn even more. And also, he has got 32 years of articles for the Morning Star, panels. I mean, a number of stupid things I said last week.
None of us can ever go into politics.
Yeah,
I think that's...
I think, and also he's given up the tactical win of being able to say this awful thing that most people hate about politics, Prime Minister's questions. He was on course to change it, and in order to get a few good write-ups in the bubble, he's going to allow Cameron to play Red Scare every week. It's lunacy.
So you think he should go back to the people's PMQs?
Yeah, people hate PMQs. No government has ever been defeated by a good PMQs. It fails to me the iron test of whether or not it's useful, which is, has anyone ever had to resign following PMQs?
Well, does it get covered on Magic FM?
And does it get covered on Magic FM? Whereas, actually, Corbyn being able to say this awful thing, this shouting match, do you remember 5 years ago when it was all the rah, rah, rah? Mm-hmm. Well, thanks to me, Jeremy Corbyn, it's over. That was a big win, and he was embarrassing to the Tories, and he'd stand up and go, I have a question from Kelly, who's about to lose.
Well, they were beginning to sort of snigger slightly, weren't they, George? They were beginning to kind of, and it was beginning to become quite awkward that you're essentially deriding a nurse on, £20,000 a year. I thought that was, what do you think, George? Do you think that he should go back to the people's PMQs?
I don't think it was sustainable for him to use every question from the public, simply because you're passing out political opportunities. Now, Stephen's quite right that a win in the bubble doesn't get you very far in terms of public opinion, but it is important in terms of managing your party and party morale. And I think had Corbyn persisted with people's PMQs, he would have found it a lot harder, even harder, to manage his MPs.
I sort of think, though, he was supposed to be getting thousands and thousands of emails every week. Presumably he could have found one that was about, oh, and here, funnily enough, Mrs. Higginbotham has come in with us, a great point on Trident. I wonder if he could have. Maybe, like most things, people were quite excited about the start and then people stopped emailing, or only people emailing about how they think the world's run by lizards. And he was going to kind of go, Mr. Cameron, I put it to you that jet fuel can't melt steel beams by 2017.
16 MPs who genuinely back him, and about 50 more who are kind of firmly in the kind of make it work, we've got to do our best to make a goer of this tendency. If they're good constituency MPs, you can drum up six good questions every week. I think also what worked was it put Cameron in the loser's corner. I mean, it won't be good for morale if he gets destroyed on being soft on terror every week.
I think it's a tough one, because I have long hated PMQs as being fully yaboo, and then John Rentoul suggests, but would you rather watch that or a select committee meeting? And I had to grudgingly concede that I'd rather, not least because PMQs is only half an hour long, whereas select committee meetings can drone on for hours and hours and hours. There is a place for kind of forensic, examination of the evidence, and there is probably also a bit of a place for shouting, much though it pains me to say so. On which note, I'll say thank you to George and Stephen.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can get this episode and everything else we've done on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The BBC has recently announced that it will be turning Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy into BBC series. I'm joined by Stephen Bush, our Staggers editor, and Barbara Speed, our technology writer, to chew over this exciting bit of news. Well, I say it's exciting because I am excited about it, because I really love these books. But this does take place in the shadow of the abomination that is The Golden Compass, which was Hollywood's attempt at making a film out of it, which featured Nicole Kidman giving it full sort of borderline Cruella de Vil,
I don't think she was the worst bit of casting, actually.
Yeah, she was quite fun.
Yeah. She at least...
She camped it up.
She did at least look the part. Whereas I think, for my money, Daniel Craig, it wasn't Dakota Fanning, it was Dakota Blue Richards.
Are you saying that all child actresses look the same?
Yep. Nondescript, frizzy hair, white, acting skills of cardboard.
That also describes all of the Harry Potter cast in the first film as well.
But in that first
how
one,
they ended up.
One, they don't really improve, but at least they're kind of cute. That is the thing about the first Harry Potter movie. You look at them and you're like,
oh, you want to ruffle your little hair, Daniel.
But Daniel Craig, who, you know, has lots of strengths as an actor in other things, but is not posh enough to be Lord Asriel. Like, it was just disastrous casting. He didn't seem to enjoy it, and everything about it was bad. It could be summed up with that awful moment with Yorick Bernson, where he kind of shouted in his Ian McKellen voice, "I'm an armored bear," and I remember everyone in the cinema just started laughing. It was just it was so bad. It was a disaster.
Was it actually Ian McKellen?
Yeah, it was Ian McKellen. Was the Iron?
I'm acting. You shall not pass. Yeah, that's what worries me. And Barbara, the other big worry is the budget. And I mean, they're crunching down all three books apparently into 8 episodes, which means they're going to have to. They never got to make a Hollywood film of the third book. I'm going to get this right. The Amber Spyglass. Which has got the weird creatures that I never really understood that don't have a spine. They've got like a diamond shaped thing,
and they roll on balls.
Put their claws through a seed pod, and then they, or which they oil, and then they roll along because they've evolved on a road that's got like ribbons of sort of, I don't know what it is. I'm going to say ribbons of asphalt naturally into ribbons of something anyway. So that's how they've evolved. That always struck me that I had no idea how those things worked, and trying to do them on the BBC budget, I'm worried that there might be a sort of disgruntled looking cow.
Rolling along on a coconut. I think though that the biggest counter to that is probably just how successful the National Theatre's production of the books was in comparison to this Hollywood film, which had about, I have no idea, but a lot more budget than the plays would have done, because they did everything slightly less hyper-realistically and more abstractly. So the demons were done with kind of these puppets that were very kind of floaty and silky. And I'm not... That might not work on a TV series, I guess. But I think you can do a lot more with sort of suggestion and kind of... I'm not sure that really hyper-real CGI is even that good anyway for this type of kind of quite magical fantasy story.
I think there's a real backlash against that hyper-real CGI because it looks so weightless. It just doesn't look
real. And that's a good word for the film, I think, that it was quite substanceless and you actually lost a lot of the character. And maybe because, for example, they did cast someone who was quite a young girl as the lead, she didn't have much to her. Whereas, if, for example, in the play, I think they cast someone who was in her late teens at least, and she then covered it as the books went on. But I think you're safer doing that and having someone who knows what they're doing, even if they don't look.
It was a bad couple of years, because that's, I think, not long before that, they ruined my other favourite children's book, The Dark is Rising trilogy, by casting Christopher Eccleston as the head of a family of Americans. And it made me much more grateful when I went around Harry Potter World recently that J.K. Rowling put her foot down and did not let them cast all... They wanted, one American, basically, to make it relatable than Harry Potter. Stephen, I've got a bigger question, which is, if you had a demon, What would it be?
Well, I think I probably have a cat demon. You know, kind of. And Barbara's shaking her head at me.
I'm going to put this out there. Your desk is not the desk of a person with a cat demon. No self-respecting
cat. Cats are big groomers.
Yeah, would have that amount of sort of bits of croissant and like stacks of paper and old biographies of Tony Blair.
I maintain that you would have a dog. That is my personal take. Demon hot take.
But quite an intelligent dog, like a collie.
Yeah, and quite
a small yappy type dog.
Mm.
Yeah.
A friendly dog.
A large, but maybe like a rescue dog, kind of one of those dogs. A dog that people, you know, felt confident in. No, okay, Barbara's saying no.
So what type of dog do you think I would have?
Oh, I don't know, I just think a rescue dog, so that sounds...
No, I mean like one that does rescues, not one that's been rescued.
Some kind of traumatised.
No, like a St. Bernard with like a little barrel of
What must
of
happen
rum.
To your soul for your demon to be a rescue dog?
That's really sad. This comes to the point that I am desperate for somebody to explain to me, which is, one is the range of animals that actually, because so we had this conversation in the office before, there's a story in the book about a sailor who ends up with a dolphin demon, and that means that he can no longer go back on land again. That's his personality. His personality is to be always at sea. And I've always thought, well, hang a minute, what about all the people who get like a, I don't know, like a sea anemone demon or a wasp demon or...
Well, I mean, the sailor who can never go ashore is told to Lyra by one of the Egyptians. I was about to explain what Egyptian was, and I suddenly remembered any listeners who don't know what we're talking about have switched off.
They've bailed out. Yeah.
Is told to her by one of the Egyptians. So, and she's a child at that point in the book. I always kind of assumed it was an old wives' tale. It's something... Because...
There's always a sense that the demon is appropriate to you. It's not going to mess up your life because... It's chosen by you in quite a subconscious way.
I mean, that'd be the thing.
Like,
think about anything over the size of a dog begins to get kind of prohibitively, you can't go into nooks.
Is it not sort of implied that demons, you know, if say you have a, you know, not a cat as I've been, so, you know, my St. Bernard would probably just be St. Bernard's size. But if I had, say, a bird, which I'm not going to claim that I have a bird demon, but if, you know, I think you probably would be slightly larger if it was, say, a small hawk, it would be quite a large hawk, but if it was a big eagle, it would be slightly smaller. What I'm more interested in is meeting etiquette, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, in a lot of meetings, I drift off. Not really, listening employers.
In a lot of conversations, to be fair.
Right. But mostly, I'm good at appearing to be
You're
listening.
A bit like when Homer Simpson does jury duty and he's got glasses with open eyes. There's a certain glazed look that you get where you can tell that you've gone somewhere, but you're functioning.
Whereas, like, what this dog Steven... demon would be pacing up and down, its tail wagging.
The cat demon would be licking its ass. And then
what would
like...
it do while you were on your phone is the biggest question.
Yes, would the St. Bernard also have Twitter?
Okay, so we can't character assassinating someone else. What demon would Barbara have?
You would need a demon with opposable thumbs. That's why this is my theory about actually when I would actually want a lemur or something like that would be quite a useful demon because then it could go and like open things, fetch you beer.
Or rescue you. I mean, if you had a monkey demon, it could feasibly pull you out of sticky situations. But if you had a wasp demon...
I don't think it could because when Pantalaimon tries to force Lyra to not go somewhere in the first book and he digs in, he ultimately loses.
But if he were rescuing her and trying to help her...
That's the thing. If you'd locked your keys in your flat, you could put your very small monkey demon through the letterbox. It could then go and fetch the key and post it back to you. Whereas, you know, good luck with
dolphin.
Your ant demon helping you out on that, with that
one. No, I don't think that works for another because I think ultimately the point is the soul can't save the body.
Mm.
They are.
Okay, yeah. So Barbara, what demon would you have?
I would have a tortoise demon.
That'd be amazing. Someone would turn it into an ashtray.
I would probably have to carry it around sometimes because it would be quite slow.
But what about when it hibernated?
I don't know if it would. I don't think they have normal animal functions.
Yeah, they don't need to be fed.
Also, I think my soul's probably asleep half the time anyway.
That's really sad. Who would be your dream casting for this BBC adaptation?
I always thought Jeremy Irons would make a good Lord Asriel.
He would, wouldn't
but
he?
But he's a bit too... He's not kind of muscular enough.
What about Charles Dance? He gave it good veterinary. Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by his veterinary in the Pratchett adaptation.
I think Asriel, he's an explorer. He's got to... I always see him as a Jason Isaacs. Do I mean Jason Isaacs? The one who's the baddie in the live-action Peter Pan. Who also plays Lucius Malfoy and is...
Maybe
even in the same wig.
And the Jackson Brody film TV shows. That guy, he's quite posh, he's very rugged. You believe he could take you on in a fight. And that was...
Ben Fogle, that's who you want.
He's a posh bloke who's seen things and he's gone a little bit strange. He's kind of like one of those Arctic explorers who, you know, it's like, why is he going it? Because it's there. And obviously then acquires as the books goes on. Yeah, but you have to believe him as someone who could be the general of an army to, spoiler alert, kill God.
It's just all ruined. But yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. And I think Mrs. Coulter's a difficult part to cast as well, because you can be tempted to go too icy, sort of, not like sex pop, but you know what I mean? Kind of slightly sadomasochistic, chilly woman. I think that you can ham that up a bit too much, I think. She's got to be someone that actually gets people to do what she wants, so she can't be a kind of like Lady Mandelson, basically kind of giving it full creature of the night.
She does actually love both Lyra and Azrael, as you see when she interacts with what's-his-face, the what's-his-trousers, the one she poisons in the second book. Lord Boreal.
Yeah. What about Lady Mary from Downton? Could she be Mrs. Coulter? Because she's sort of icy yet has feelings.
I can kind of see that. I guess the trouble is with Lyra and Will, you sort of presume that they will end up casting unknown actors in them, which can very much go either way. You can end up... Yeah. The trouble is, I always feel with child actors that you can end up going somebody who is a bit too stage school, and they just give it a bit sort of like, and now go away.
I think they can get away with having someone who's just 20 now. And I think they probably should.
I think the dream casting for Lyra would be Maisie Williams.
Ooh.
Just to throw that in there.
Oh, yeah. And she, because she looks younger than her age as well, doesn't she?
And she has, but she's been really good in Doctor Who. And she's also got that intelligent... I mean, the way that she plays her character in Arya in Game of Thrones is quite Lyra-ish, isn't it? It's just somebody who lies all the time, who tells stories, who is kind of untrustworthy, and which is what you want for that character.
They also have the advantage that because it's just 8 episodes, they don't have to do that thing with films where you have to... where child actors are like this weird investment where you have to hope their voices don't change
and they don't get really ugly, just give them different clothes.
And so they can cast someone who's actually slightly too old for the role,
and film it all in a year. Okay, well that's good, we sorted out. BBC, get on the phone, thank you everyone. From all of us, goodbye.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.